Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm so excited to be talking with Kristen Dumay, the author of the new book that's just about to come out, Jesus and John Wayne. Thank you so much, Kristen, for joining me.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
I've just finished reading your book, I think about a week ago. Thank you so much for sending me an advanced copy. I just kind of whizzed through it, reading it on the iPad. Absolutely fascinated because it's my own story coming out of evangelicalism, coming out of the Promise Keepers movement and all that. So masculine, muscular Christianity, that's kind of the thesis of your book, isn't it?
Yeah. I wanted to write a history of white evangelical masculinity and militarism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did a great job. So what led you to research and write this book on this topic? I mean, what's the connection between John Wayne, the sort of iconic American cowboy, the Duke, and Jesus? I mean, John Wayne, he was no evangelical, let's be honest.
Especially
after the Playboy,
the Playboy magazine
interview, shocking racism and, you know, xenophobia and all the rest of it. What's he got to do with Jesus?
Yeah, so John Wayne was not an evangelical, although interestingly enough, there have been rumors circulated since his death that he converted to evangelicalism on his deathbed. Hmm. He did not. Just the fact that the rumors persist, I think, is telling. So the book is about white evangelical understandings of masculinity, and I read hundreds of books on Christian manhood published by, you know, Christian publishers, written by evangelicals. And what initially surprised me was that, you know, for all of their talk of upholding the authority of the scriptures, of being Bible believing Christians, when it came to talking about Christian manhood, Bible verses were few and far between, or any sort of, you know, real biblical exegesis. Instead, they based a lot of their conceptions of Christian manhood on kind of mythical heroes, on secular models of masculinity, on ancient warriors, on cowboys and soldiers and Hollywood movies. So Mel Gibson's William Wallace of Braveheart is a favorite, but so was John Wayne. And John Wayne just kept popping up in book after book as the icon of Christian manhood, which when, again, you know about his life, his, you know, his multiple marriages, his racism and all of these things, you think, you know, what is it about John Wayne that elevates him to this status? And what it comes down to really is, you know, John Wayne was this model of white militant masculinity on screen and off. And he was the militant white man who was going to bring order through violence. The ends would justify the means. You need to be crass. You need to be tough because you have a battle to fight. And that's what really drew them to John Wayne, both the man and the myth.
Of course, it feeds into that Western trope, that American mythology too, doesn't it? He's obviously right in the vein of all those classic Western movies that we think of coming out of the, 40s and 50s, where the good guy with a gun kills the bad guy with a gun. The good guys wear the white hats, bad guys wear the black hats. So that's part of this whole toxic masculinity as well, surely.
Yeah. Oh, he is perfect. He's perfect. Because he's the original kind of, you know, cowboy hero, and he especially appeals to evangelicals who had moved from the American South to the West. So these Sun Belt evangelicals, many of them settle in Orange County, California, and that really becomes the seedbed for the religious right. And they take with them kind of their Southern sensibilities, but also a real emphasis on individualism. And evangelicalism as a faith already has its own emphasis on individualism. But then you kind of transport it to this Western environment, and that just dovetails so nicely with the cowboy mythology. And it gets wrapped up with, you know, this rugged masculinity and violence, and but always in the pursuit of good, as they define good. And you're right, it's good guys versus bad guys. And just by virtue of being a good guy, you can pretty much do whatever you want in order to, you know, bring about the happy ending, to bring about the, you know, the righteousness that you are pursuing. And so this cowboy mythology is very popular among Western evangelicals, but then it really gets exported throughout evangelicalism from that Southern California kind of epicenter.
When I started reading your book, I immediately thought of Callum Brown's book, where it's The Death of Christian Britain. Now, I read that a few years ago for a book review that I did, and I immediately thought, okay, Kristen, you're kind of picking up where he leaves off, because it seems like the thesis of his book is, he says, in Victorian Britain, and to some extent in America too, that Christianity had become feminized and femininity had become Christianized.
Yes.
So the ideal person that Victorian Britons and probably Americans to some extent held up as the ideal of Christianity were women.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, so you're picking up kind of where he leaves off. Coming into the 20th century, there's this need, or perceived need, among men for a more muscular, masculine Christianity. Would you kind of pick up that thread a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. It was really hard to know where to start this book, right? Do I start it in the 1970s? No, I really need to start in the 1940s. But no, I really need to go back to at least the 1910s and then really the 1870s. And so in this introduction, I try to do a kind of quick overview. But you're right. In the 19th century, that's when historians often talk about the feminization of Victorian Christianity. And but as a historian, you have to be careful with such concepts. What does feminine mean? Because femininity and masculinity are fluid constructs. They change over time. Christianity is very dynamic, and Christian models of femininity and masculinity change, as do secular models. And so it gets to be a very complicated narrative. But yes, in the 19th century, you do see, for a variety of economic and cultural and religious reasons, the kind of elevation of a more sentimental Christianity, a more affective faith, at the same time as you start to have the elevation of female virtue. So in American history, for example, in Puritan New England, you had patriarchal Christianity, but when it came to notions like sin, you know, who was more fallen, men or women, they were pretty egalitarian. Everybody was, right? And everybody needed to, like, be redeemed. Right. And work out their own salvation with fear and trembling. That kind of changes by the 19th century, again, for complicated reasons, where virtue gets kind of coded feminine, because men then are going off to work in more entrepreneurial capitalism, and it's a dog-eat-dog world. But what's going to happen to social virtue? While women, who are separate from that competitive economic sphere, they stay in the home, they'll be the source of this virtue. And so we do have the kind of feminization of virtue and somewhat of Christianity as well, because it's of Christian virtue. That said, there were also models of masculinity in the 19th century that elevated self-restraint, right? Gentlemanly restraint, and that were much more compatible with this notion of, you know, 19th century virtue, a Christian virtue, this more restrained model. What really changes by the early 20th century is American culture. We see some similar things happening in the British world as well, starts to kind of change its conceptions of masculinity. Because again, the economy changes, the nature of work changes. You have a lot of men working as kind of, you know, just punching the clock or middle managers. They weren't working with their hands. They didn't own their own farms. They weren't, you know, real kind of strong, working with physical strength. And so we have a kind of crisis of masculinity that develops. And from that moment, when they look back, that's when they say, whoa, Christianity got feminized in the 19th century. And we have to take back Christianity and pair it with this rugged, muscular manhood. And so Christianity kind of gets transformed.
So would you say that's kind of the defining narrative in the last 100, 120 years or so, where there's this sudden realization, hey, wait a minute, we've got to reclaim Christianity for men and make it tough again. So you see the warriors, the cowboys, because John Wayne didn't just play cowboys. Of course, he played in many war movies. So yeah. Even though he never served in the military.
Right. No. No. It's a myth. It's all the myths are extremely powerful. So yes, we have a kind of recurring discovery of crisis. So always be suspicious if you come across, this is a crisis of manhood. This is and look at how is that being used and who is it being used to subject really. So yes, it kind of comes and goes. What we see happening, we see a resurgence in the early 20th century of a kind of muscular Christianity, and it is caught up in some cases with American nationalism, especially the Teddy Roosevelt years. But by the time you get to World War I, we still have a lot of ambivalence. So you'll have liberal Christians who are very militant. You'll have many conservative Christians, fundamentalists, who might seem militant in their faith, but are actually pretty skeptical of American nationalism. Mm. They're skeptical that the American nation can actually be, Christian, because it's this kind of evil secular space. Mm-hmm. So the kind of set of issues that we really see framing contemporary evangelicalism comes together in the post World War II era. That's when you see conservative theology, this patriarchal Christianity going hand in hand with a resurgent Christian nationalism. And a very militant Christian nationalism because of the threat of communism, the threat of the Cold War. And so that's when we really see this package coming together of patriarchy and Christian nationalism, and each really reinforces the other. And yes, you're right. So John Wayne, he's just the perfect guy because
he's everywhere.
He's the cowboy. He's the cowboy hero. And then he's the World War II hero, right?
Absolutely.
And in Vietnam. Vietnam, right. So he takes the cowboy, carries that into World War II, and then the World War II gets carried into Vietnam. So we have the good war soldier playing that role in Vietnam, which is what American conservatives desperately wanted, right? To redeem the American soldier and American militancy in the Vietnam era when so many other Americans were having second thoughts.
I was just listening on the way home from work today of Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead's book, Taking America Back for God. Yes. You were talking about Christian nationalism, and they were making the point in the chapter I was listening to that they say that societies where there's a traditional kind of patriarchal model, when they feel like that starts to get undermined, then there's an appeal to this patriarchal, muscular sort of Christianity. You know, you look at the 60s and 70s, as you were saying, you've got Equal Rights Amendment, you've got more, gay rights, homosexual rights. These things are like dog whistles to the conservatives saying it's undermining the family. The traditional family is now being attacked. Look at, and then all these organizations come out of that, focus on the family, the Family Research Council, and on with the word family, traditional gendered stereotypes and all the rest of it.
Exactly. So yeah, Sam and Andrew and I were writing our books at the same time, and we were in touch with each other and seeing the same things and putting the same pieces together. They as sociologists and I as a historian. Mm-hmm. So our work actually overlaps very nicely. It's complementary, and it actually our narratives reinforce each other. So yes, we have what was really startling to me when I went back to the sources from the 1960s and 1970s from Family Values Evangelical. Evangelicalism, from evangelical writings on sexuality, even reading sex manuals, and on this family values evangelicalism, James Dobson's focus on the family, was just how much this family values framework or belief system was oriented towards the Christian nation and looking globally, and was connected to the defense of Christian America through military strength. I mean, you don't have to look far to see these connections are everywhere. So you need a strong man in the home, and it's the wife's job to put together his tattered ego, and the bedroom is the best place to do that. And she must absolutely submit to him sexually and socially, because that's God's command, and because that, again, like patches up together his ego so that he can lead in the church and in the nation. And so that we have to raise strong boys and tough boys so that they can fight on the battlefields of North Vietnam, because clearly there was a major problem with American manhood that they couldn't defeat a ragtag enemy in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And so this family values discourse is always, from its very inception, wrapped up in militarism, and in Christian nationalism. And that really makes sense when you realize that at the heart of family values, evangelicalism really is militant white masculinity. And as long as you hold that together, everything that happens from that time on really makes sense, including our current moment.
Right. What about some of the early leaders? Can we talk about some of the guys that were kind of influential in getting this movement off the ground? You've got guys like R.J. Rushdoony, Christian mm-hmm. Reconstructionism, Bill Gothard. Yeah. I was raised in the Bill Gothard movement as a kid, so I grew up in that movement, so I'm very wow. familiar with Bill Gothard. Dr. James Dobson, we mentioned a minute ago, focus on the mm-hmm. family. What about some of these guys? What were their contributions to this sort of muscular Christianity?
Yeah, so when I first started this project, I really didn't have my eye on Rushdoony and Gothard. Mm-hmm. I think like many scholars of evangelicalism, had kind of bought into this, you know, mainstream versus margins. And it seemed like, you know, when you're going to talk about somebody like Rushdoony, right away you're opening yourself up to criticism of, oh, come on, you know, those are the fringe, the far right. And, you know, same thing with Gothard, you know. And the more that I was researching and then talking with evangelicals themselves, much like yourself, I was told you have to look at Gothard. And I was surprised by how many people had been brought up by Gothard's mm-hmm. teachings directly. And of course, part of his strategy was to keep things secret, right? To do it through his own seminars, to mm-hmm. not have this public platform, but to really work, you know, directly and through network. And that worked phenomenally well. So I started to kind of move back and say, okay, I have to understand Gothard and I have to understand Rushdoony. And as mm-hmm. you know, Rushdoony ends up being, particularly through the Howard Phillips connection, key to kind of the leading architects of the religious right as a political movement, right? He's mm-hmm. kind of in the shadows there. But then when I went back and looked at James Dobson's work, you know, very mainstream conservative evangelicalism, I realized that the things he was saying about masculinity and femininity, about order in society, about shoring up patriarchal authority were exactly like, you know, maybe a slightly softer, you know, Southern California version mm-hmm. of Bill Gothard. And I started to realize that, I started to really question, you know, what is fringe? What is mainstream? And how are they connected? And where are kind of the boundaries in this movement? And so that's what I tried to do throughout the book, and particularly in that section looking at the 1970s, where some of the radical fringe ends up saying, you know, pretty much the same thing as the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And for evangelical consumers, they may enter the movement through the homeschool network, which is going to be more of the extreme variety, the biblical patriarchy. They may enter through Focus on the Family radio, through a suburban megachurch. But by and large, they're kind of consuming the same ideology. And that was really important for me to kind of map out and realize, again, how we've come to where we are now in terms of the identity of white evangelicals.
Mm-hmm. So these are some of the early pioneers of this sort of biblical patriarchy movement. Mm-hmm. As I was saying, I grew up during the Bill Gothard era in Seattle. My parents took us to the seminars at the Seattle Center when mm-hmm. I was a kid. I think I was 13 when I went to my first one. You had to be a certain age to start attending. I went for several years and they tried to raise us in this model. And it was so ironic that that ended up contributing to a lot of problems in my parents' marriage because according to Gothard's, as you say, this masculine biblical patriarchy model, my father had to be the head of the house, the spiritual yes. leader and all the rest of it. But my mom was a much more of a strong personality. And mm-hmm. so she had to knuckle under basically. Yes. And that was not their roles really before that. And so it caused all kinds of problems. So the model itself, I think, is deeply flawed from just that point of view alone. Growing up, I experienced it.
Yeah. It causes a lot of damage, a lot of harm individually, within families, and I think socially and politically as well. And, you know, I thought for a long time that it was fringe. And then when I was talking over this research 3 or 4 years ago with my own mom before she passed away, she told me a story that I never heard before, which is when I was a newborn, she was at the playground with my older brother and me, and she was a new parent and mm-hmm. you know, trying to figure out how to raise kids. And some moms approached her on the playground in the small town in Iowa and said, you know, you're doing things wrong. Here's how you discipline children to be godly. And they gave mm-hmm. her the pamphlets and they invited her to their group. And she talked it over with my dad, who was a ordained pastor and theology professor. Mm-hmm. And they very prayerfully considered this. And in the end, they decided not to go with it.
You're lucky.
And so I dodged a bullet there. But, you know, it was, that's the way in my small town in Iowa, they were also reaching out and, you know, come with us. And to hear about how my mom, they didn't just write this off. They very prayerfully thought about it because they absolutely wanted to raise godly children. And what parent doesn't need a little advice, right? And so they were definitely receptive to this.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book that this kind of model has been softened a little bit in the last 20, maybe 25 years. There's been books like Stu Weber's The Tender Warrior, yeah. Of course, the Promise Keepers movement, which I was a part of in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So there's this complementarian thing. Now that's kind of more palatable. Would you say that it's more of an effort to sell this, kind of soft sell the biblical patriarchy, the sort of hard model didn't really sell as well in some evangelical circles? Just taking a super short break here in my chat with Kristen Dumais. We'll be right back in just a few minutes. I just wanted to bring you up to date on a couple of things. One of the things before I forget is I want to give you the whole title of her book. I just mentioned at the beginning that it was called Jesus and John Wayne, but it's subtitled How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. And we'll get back into it in just a minute. We're going to pick back up this thread of toxic, masculine, male Christianity, and really what some of the implications have been on churches and organizations that have attempted to live out that philosophy of ministry. What's the outcome is not really that good, actually. There's been a lot of scandals, and we're going to get into that in the second half. I just wanted to mention what's coming up in the next few weeks. I've got a chat with Rob Boston of the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. That is going to be a fantastic episode, so that's going to drop next in a couple of weeks. This one here is a bonus episode because it's timed on Tuesday the 23rd, which coincides with the release of Kristen's book. So as of today, Tuesday the 23rd of June 2020, that book is available. You can get it on Amazon as well as in other bookstores. So I encourage you to get it because I've read all the way through it. She sent me an advanced copy as a PDF and it was fantastic. As I said in the beginning, this is basically my own story. I grew up in evangelicalism. I grew up in a culture of biblical patriarchy, and I saw the effects of it in my own life and in the lives of other people. So now that it is officially released, you can go ahead and get yourself a copy of Jesus and John Wayne. I just wanted to mention one other thing. I want to give a thank you to all the people on Patreon who have been supporting this show for a while. It was your support that enabled me to be able to pay for Zoom for the entire year. So that was really cool to be able to do that, save a little bit of money on a full year's purchase of Zoom. And that goes, of course, to our Mindshift Zoom calls, as well as the online course that I'm right in the middle of right now. This is our third week going into the fourth week, talking about dominion theology. Next week, we're going to be talking about Christian homeschooling, which is what Dr. Milton Gaither and I talked about in the last episode that just dropped the other day. So if you haven't heard that and you're interested in the history of Christian homeschooling, then give that episode a listen. What I would say, though, is, yeah, if you want to support the show on Patreon, that is hugely helpful. The links to that are in the show notes. As always, you get early releases of the episodes on Wednesdays before they drop as normal on the Fridays. You also get access to our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And of course, that includes admission to our monthly Mindshift Zoom calls. And in fact, it's not too late to join us this Sunday, the 28th of June. We've got David from the Graceful Atheist podcast dropping in this month. And one other really cool development, if this comes off, I've been in talks with Kristen here. We're hoping to have her as our guest in July. So I'll keep you posted as we know more. If we can arrange a date, that would be absolutely fantastic. All right, so let's get back into the talk with Kristen Cobes-Dumais as we continue to explore what exactly is that connection between Jesus and John Wayne, and what better place to see that connection than in the Promise Keepers movement.
Yeah, so in the 1990s, especially with, you know, you bring up Promise Keepers, and for many people, that's probably the only association they have with the evangelical men's movement or with evangelical masculinity. Mm-hmm. Promise Keepers got a lot of bad press. from, you know, National Organization for Women and from liberals. But really, if you look in the kind of sweep of evangelical history, the Promise Keepers was this moment of kind of stepping back from the harsher and more conservative kind of tropes of biblical patriarchy for a couple of reasons, I think. One, again, this is always linked to foreign policy. And the Promise Keepers emerged in the early 1990s, just after the end of the Cold War. And so the communist enemy had been vanquished. Do we need this militancy anymore? There was this kind of opening up within evangelicalism of rethinking our politics, rethinking our foreign policy, rethinking what it is to be an American evangelical. And it's in that space that this really blossoms, I think, this the Promise Keepers movement. Mm-hmm. Now, within that movement, you will still have some of the harsher patriarchy, but you will also have things even bordering on egalitarianism and this kind of therapeutic, you know, lots of hugging and getting in touch with your emotions. And that's not just cover, right? It isn't just a cover for what we really want is this harsh patriarchy, but this is only what, you know, people are going to take. There was a real opening up in the movement itself. But then by the end of that decade, there's a backlash that's emerging, a backlash against this kind of touchy-feely, sentimental masculinity. And particularly conservatives within the movement are starting to say, no. We need to embrace this much more rugged, tough masculinity. And that's where we have, you know, James Dobson is part of that, getting back to the tougher testosterone-driven masculinity. And other writers, and then John Eldredge is perhaps the most famous one. But all of these books are written, and they are on the shelves in 2001, just before 9/11 hit, right? And so you have this turn, this kind of backlash to the softer patriarchy of the 1990s. These books are on the shelves just when suddenly we have a very real battle to fight. And this return to militancy, and again, we see foreign policy and these domestic ideals go hand in hand, and that just launched this much more aggressive version of evangelical masculinity at just the right time in terms of evangelical politics and this kind of hard right turn. So it's anti-Islamic, it's in support of preemptive war, condoning the use of torture, you know, pro-gun, pro-violence. It's very tough. And that's when you can really see the fruits of this. It's personal, but it's also absolutely political.
Absolutely. Especially when you connect that with the Christian nationalism, as you're saying, they're always looking for those figures. They had the John Wayne, you talk about Oliver North. He was a figure. You have now General Boykin, you know, people like him, they'll go and speak in churches in full uniform, military uniform with flags everywhere. And they're just marrying this Christian nationalist with the religious piece. Christianity's married to America, apparently. And like I said, then there's the wars. I mean, I read the Land letter that they wrote to President Bush, basically giving their warrant for why you need to go into Iraq and invade. And it's all theologically justified. It's shocking when you read that letter signed by prominent evangelicals.
Exactly. Just really goading the administration on, assuring them that God was on their side and that they had full right to unilaterally, go into Iraq. And it was really striking. That was actually the moment when I started to study evangelical masculinity. Mm. It was during the Iraq War. Because I had students at that time bring to me a copy of John Eldredge's book. So again, I teach at a Christian university, I teach American history, and I had just finished a unit on Teddy Roosevelt. And it was, you know, Roosevelt as this masculine, you know, nationalist hero. And so we talked about race and gender and power and things like that. And they came to me after class and said, you know, Professor Dumais, you really need to read this book. And it's at that time, like all the guys were reading it in their campus Bible studies. Soon after they gave me a copy, my own church was hosting Wild at Heart Bible Studies for Men and then Captivated Bible Studies for Women. And of course, my students knew why it was significant, because this was the moment when we really saw this rising militancy within white evangelicalism in the context of the Iraq War. They were absolutely pushing war and pushing militancy within the Republican Party and across the board, and all of the survey data data. I mean, white evangelicals are the outliers. Mm-hmm. And so you could see how this kind of warrior masculinity absolutely went hand in hand with actual militancy. Mm-hmm. And that's when we see also this relationship really secured between the U.S. military and American evangelicals. Now, evangelicals had been ministering to the military since really World War II and the Korean War. Vietnam was a critical moment of cooperation. And then in the 80s, James Dobson really worked to solidify that relationship. So there's nothing really new there, but it really comes into fruition by the early 2000s. And you're right, you have people like General Boykin and Oliver North earlier, and he's, well, earlier, and he stays around. He's a very popular figure within these circles still. What is a really interesting moment is that the glorification of the military has taken hold to such an extent that military leaders, military officials actually become the highest spiritual authorities. Mm-hmm. And so now you have military figures who are writing devotionals for men, because we all know, right, within this worldview, that the military man is the godliest. And so ordinary Christian men can up their spiritual game by practicing this military religion and this militant spirituality. And that has really, for a couple of decades, has characterized a lot of popular writing on evangelical masculinity.
Mm-hmm. It's so amazing to see how that works. And I know one of the things Perry and Whitehead talk about in their book, one of the reasons why evangelicals are so quick to praise the military is they'll say, if it wasn't for the military and all these wars that we've won, we wouldn't be enjoying the freedoms to worship our God in the way we see fit. So of course, they are literally protecting our religious liberty. That's where they make the connection, isn't it? It's
exactly.
Not just about our freedoms that we might enjoy as Americans, just generally, it's religious freedom. And we have our military to thank specifically for that. So it's a good thing.
Exactly. Because they are defending Christian America, right? They don't separate America from Christian America. So they are defending our faith. In the time after September 11, James Dobson came out, you know, saying the greatest threat to our families is Islamic terrorism, right? I mean, he'll come right out, and he's just a central character throughout this whole narrative. And then you get to the whole story of the, you know, fake ex-Muslim terrorists that are all the rage. Yeah, I mean, some of them came to my own university, and that's how I first learned about these guys. And so we have these, you know, quote unquote ex-terrorists who come and visit the, you know, work for Focus on the Family and CBN, and they're part of this Christian conference circuit, making tons of money.
Yeah, they got books and everything.
Oh, yeah. You know, speaking to evangelicals, telling them how Muslims are out to kill them. Mm-hmm. And these guys are total frauds. But long after they're completely discredited, evangelical organizations and institutions and publishers are still promoting them. And to me, that was a really critical moment in my own research when I had to wrap my head around what's actually happening here. You know, so much of the narrative of white evangelicals in politics in the last few years has really circled around fear. Evangelicals are so afraid. And so they vote for somebody like Trump because they had no other choice. They are terrified at losing their religious liberty. Mm-hmm. They're just very, very afraid. But when I looked at that, the story of the ex-Muslim terrorists, however you want to say it,
all of you are.
That's not really what was happening. It was evangelical leaders were very intentionally stoking fear in the hearts of evangelicals. And it was a false fear in this case. And so I really started to flip that narrative. You know, are evangelicals becoming militant because they're so desperately afraid and this is their last resort? Or does their militancy come first? And that requires the continual stoking of fear in order to consolidate power for their militant leaders. And that's really where I end up in the book.
Well, I love what you said in the book. You said something like Islamophobia has now replaced the communist threat from the previous generations. And that's the new bogeyman. They have to have an enemy. They have to have someone they can vilify. And like you say, stoke fear.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. Because I never heard of those ex-Muslim terrorists either till I read your book. And then I went and looked them up and I found some videos on YouTube. They appeared on CBN. They were talking, telling their story about all this stuff. And then I Anderson Cooper debunked them. And yet they are still.
Yeah,
they're speaking
just
to law enforcement agencies and all the rest of it, Bible colleges, seminaries, churches, anywhere that they can get an audience.
Exactly.
And they're hugely popular.
Jerry Boykin has teamed up with Salim now, I think. You know, you can just keep tracking these guys, and they just don't go away.
But yet, how many evangelical dominionists and guys like David Barton? He's been thoroughly debunked. His book, The Jefferson Lies, was so inaccurate historically. It was pulled from the shelves by its publisher, Thomas Nelson, I think it was. And yet he's everywhere.
Right. So that's the thing. Right? There is this really powerful evangelical subculture. Mm. And many evangelicals are completely immersed in this. And so they're listening to Christian radio. They're getting their news from Christian radio and maybe Fox News and talk radio. And so they're not encountering, you know, stories of, oh, this has been debunked, or they are still trusting their sources. And, you know, if Dobson is still, you know, endorsing this, and if their own communities have not abandoned them. And besides, they've also been really trained to be highly suspicious of the quote unquote secular media, or this us versus them mentality. And that has been a persistent theme that I try to kind of draw through the book as well, that it's very hard to kind of disrupt this ideology, because of the suspicion that's part of it, of this us versus them. Do not trust anybody on the outside. They do not have God's truth. And in this cosmic battle, they are our enemies. Do not trust them. It was fascinating to see that in the local church level. You know, so Mark Driscoll is probably the clearest example of this, but Jerry Falwell Sr., you have this as well. This idea that God's truth is contained within these walls, within this church community. Do not venture out, because dangers lurk there in sin and evil. And to hear how people in those churches talked about this, I mean, they really believed that. They believed that to stay in God's good grace and to have a source of God's truth, you needed to stay within those walls. And I think that that happens in local church communities, but it's happened writ large in American evangelicalism as well.
I was just about to bring up Mark Driscoll. So thank you for...
Yes.
Going there, because I went to Mark Driscoll's church. I visited his church. I wasn't a member of his church. When I was living in Portland, we went up to Seattle one of the weekends years and years ago when he was at his mega church in Ballard in Seattle. And we thought, I got to go visit this guy, because at the time, this was probably, late 90s. So he was in his prime, early 2000s. And this was a phenomenon. We had to see what this was all about. This is sort of the biblical patriarchy gone to an extreme. He's the clearest example in the last 10 or 15 years of an abusive jerk, really, who bullied people and did all sorts of stuff. But he got away with it forever.
He did.
There's a downside. And I appreciate the fact that in the book, you go into the many scandals that have followed in the wake of what happens when you have churches and organizations that allow their leaders and pastors to live out this tough, rough, masculine personality leader.
Exactly. And he was so important, not just as a kind of extreme model of what this militant masculinity looks like, and, you know, extremely crass, extremely misogynistic, abusive in terms of abusive power. And yet, you know, he was really lifted up among an entire generation of evangelical pastors as this is our role model. This is the guy that we follow. And what was really interesting to me was to see how other evangelical pastors kind of gave him a pass, right? Well, you know, he might be a little rough around the edges.
Yeah, you know,
we might not go along with everything he says, but wow, he's doing the work of the Lord, you know?
Can't ignore the numbers. The churches are growing like crazy.
So he really did provide a model. And I think we shouldn't underestimate his influence and just that kind of style, that crassness that, again, the traditional Christian virtues don't really apply. You know, that's the pussified America, pussified nation. And he may be an extreme example, but yeah, we see that that resonates widely across the evangelical world. And even after his downfall, you know, that model has persisted. And you see that in many corners of the SBC, certainly in independent fundamental Baptist circles. And you're right, in the last years, we've seen kind of the fruits of that power structure in terms of just countless horrific stories of abuse within these churches and institutions. So sexual abuse and abuse of power. And it really is pervasive. And it's not just the abuse, but the similar patterns within these communities, once that abuse is exposed, of wanting to cover it up, wanting to condone it, wanting to push to forgive, and really ostracizing, in many cases, the victims, and continuing to prop up the authority of the perpetrators. And to understand that that's what's been operative within evangelical communities for a long time really helped me to understand evangelical support for Donald Trump and their persisting support even after the Access Hollywood tapes released, their support for Roy Moore, their support for Kavanaugh, right? That these are patterns that should not be shocking. This is not a betrayal of evangelical values. We can really see that these are patterns that are longstanding and very much in line with evangelical values if we understand them correctly.
Absolutely. Look at Mark Driscoll. 5 minutes after he gets shit canned from Mars Hill in Seattle, he's opening up another church in Arizona, being endorsed by some pretty key leaders. And you've got guys like John Piper and, you know, they're backing him. Okay, he does not have the influence that he once did, obviously, but he has really not suffered any major consequences other than losing his big platform with Mars Hill and Acts 29. But basically, he's just gone on. But what, one of the things I got from your book was exactly what you said, that it really was laying that groundwork for why Trump, because all the patriarchy, all the muscular, you know, like Mark Driscoll, he's saying the things that we wish we could say. I'm sure a lot of pastors thought that, that secretly they believed it. He was, he had the balls to say it. Okay, he got in trouble for it, but he was saying it. Now, Trump is doing the same thing, isn't he? And he has, that's his whole platform. He was saying all the things that people were thinking but weren't brave enough to say. And they're like, yeah, he's going to fight for us. We need that tough John Wayne type guy in the White House.
Exactly. So, you know, a lot of evangelical men who maybe have read these books, who have been ministered to by pastors who bought into this, who've come under the influence one way or another, they are not living this out in their daily lives necessarily. You know, for some of them, their wives just aren't going to put up with it. Actually, for many. And for others, it's just, it's not a right, it's not a good fit. You know, this doesn't mesh with every personality. And it's actually really hard to live into this, you know, rough, tough, militant masculinity, especially in 21st century America, where a lot of men are working office jobs. And this is something they regularly reflect on, you know, this is hence their, you know, crisis of masculinity. So many people in their personal lives now, some are following through, especially on, you know, patriarchal authority in the home, on masculine leadership and keeping women in submissive positions in their churches, absolutely, and many in their homes. So it's very real.
Doug Wilson's and all those kinds.
On the other hand, there are also, as you suggest, many men who aren't all in, right? They're not, you know, swearing left and right. They're still following, you know, some of more the traditional virtues. But when they see men who are not constrained, you know, by, as they might say, political correctness, when they see the guy who is able to just do what has to be done, there's this kind of admiration. And also, I think a bit of feeling of insufficient masculinity, right? Hey, these guys kind of deserve to lead because they, as you say, they have the balls to do it.
Yep, they're doing it. Well, last question then, what do you see as the future of this movement? Because a couple of numbers that have come out lately, one of the things, there was an article that came out about the Southern Baptist Convention. They are losing numbers like they haven't since the last 30 years. They're going down. And we've seen recently, there's some of the stuff that's gone on with the Trump photo op of the Bible in front of the church and the way he's handled the coronavirus and some other things. We're hearing whispers that his evangelical base, the numbers are declining. Now, I don't know what you think about that, but we've heard this before, I think.
We said,
this is it. His base is cracking. It's not going to be sustained. You know, so what happens in 2020 and what happens going forward? What do you see as the future of all this?
Oh, it is so hard to predict. But you're right, that evangelical support for Trump, while it has wavered from time to time, it has proven incredibly resilient, and it mm-hmm. keeps coming back up to somewhere between 77 and 81%. So I'm going to wait and see when it comes to the election. Now, that said, you know, the last few months have been historically unprecedented. And as a historian, yeah. I don't use that phrase lightly.
That's one way to say it.
But I would also say that in terms of kind of sustaining this militancy and this culture of militant masculinity, I think that it might be weakening because I don't see the same strength of the evangelical subculture that I did in the early 2000s, in the 1980s and 1990s, in part because the world has changed. And so with social media now, I mean, it used to be possible if you were an evangelical to really be contained within a bubble. You know, you listen to Christian radio. I never listened to secular music on the radio. I thought that was sinful. I only listened to CCM.
Same here.
And yeah, so it was easier, I think, to exist in that bubble. And I only shopped at the Christian bookstore, you know, that sort of thing. I didn't go to other bookstores. And that has kind of broken down. I mean, Christian bookstores don't exist anymore. You can go online, but most people just go Amazon. You know, this is social media. We've got Twitter. We've got Instagram. And I think that cultural boundary is much more porous now for the up-and-coming generation. I think they're being exposed to a lot more diversity, different voices. And so I don't think that the culture itself has the same hold on the younger evangelicals today. So if there's hope for change, I mean, on the one hand, studying this history, I can say this ideology is deeply entrenched within white evangelicalism.
Absolutely.
But if you look at the youngest generation right now, coming of age, and even the 20-somethings, I don't think it has as tight of a hold on that generation as it has had on your generation, my generation, and those who are parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't talk about this, but there's another concern. We were talking about American Christianity, but look at how it's been exported worldwide. That's a whole nother piece that I'm sure we can get into some other time. But
it is a whole other book, frankly.
Yeah. The Gospel Coalition, for example,
yes.
John Piper, they've got certainly thousands of churches in America, but they're also the Gospel Coalition International. So there are churches all around the world that are buying into their version of complementarian biblical patriarchy, and they may not know any better or may reinforce their traditional stereotypes. So they're exporting it worldwide.
It is. You know, I had initially intended to have a much larger section on the book. I just bring this up in passing in the conclusion because I've done a significant amount of research on this and it is daunting. It will require another standalone book.
Mm-hmm.
And but I have been contacted through this research by people in other countries who are sharing their stories. In fact, there's going to be an article on my book published in China, in Chinese, because the Gospel Coalition and other conservative networks have made deep inroads into Chinese Christianity. And as you suggest, it's this kind of American-style Christian nationalism and patriarchy, which then interacts with more local patriarchies and local nationalisms. And we're not done with this yet. I think we're going to continue to see the ripple effect around the world, you know, in Hungary, in Russia, in Asia, in Latin America. The story has not ended.
Mm-hmm. And I'm researching the dominionist side of the whole story, which is, I mean, we didn't really get into that. We talked about Rush Dooney a little bit, but that's my fascination, is how they justify the whole thing theologically and biblically, which is obviously part of the philosophy of ministry or whatever you want to call it, as far as how they're doing it and why they think they need to do all this. So there's another piece right there. I'm working on a book on Rush Dooney, so we have to collaborate somewhere.
Bless you on that. Yes, that is, you're right. That's the kind of, a lot of the people who are buying into this ideology don't actually dig deep into the theology. You know, it's kind of cultural ethos and identity. But you're right. If you need the theological foundations, you know, Rush Dooney's got them for you.
Yeah, he does. He was one of the first, if not the first, to lay it all out systematically, I guess you could say. So a lot of the threads come out of Christian Reconstructionism and Dominion Theology and all that, but that's a topic for another day. Yes. I have one last question then. Where can people find your book? When does it come out? and how can they get a hold of you? I guess three questions, I guess.
Yeah. So the book comes out June 23. So you can pre-order it now and it should arrive right around that time. It's available, in the United States through any bookstore. It's also widely available through Amazon. First check your local bookstore and see about ordering directly if at all possible. You can follow me on Twitter at KK Dumez, KKDUMEZ. I also have an author page on Facebook, also KK Dumez. And I have a website, KristenDumez.com.
Listen, Kristen, I have absolutely enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much for doing all this work. 10 years or so of research is finally starting to pay off.
Yes, thank you. This has been great.